All right, everybody, welcome to the January 20th edition of Cascadian Views. JJ's under the weather a bit, so it's me and Dan today. How you doing?
Doing all right, Brock. How are you?
I am all right. My life has continued to function despite the government shutdown, which is our big story of the week. As of midnight last night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, the government stopped. This is not altogether unexpected, although Trump did have a meeting with Schumer and Pelosi attempting to head it off. He called it a preliminary meeting in a tweet, said they had a great preliminary meeting. It came 3 hours before the shutdown of the government was scheduled to happen, so a little late on your preliminaries there, I believe. Mitch McConnell took hostage-taking to really just a new level, elevated to an art form, I would say. His official Twitter account tweeted out a photo that had on one side protections for 600,000 undocumented immigrants, and on the other side it said healthcare funding for 6 million American kids. Democrats have an easy choice. That didn't have to be a choice. You fucks let the CHIP funding expire, and you fucks held up DACA, when even the president at one point agreed that these two things would be married together.
Right. Yeah, this is entirely of the Republicans' making. You know, CHIP, that was actually set to expire. They were supposed to pass a new bill back in September, but they were too busy, you know, working on tax cuts and too busy working on that last-ditch effort. That was what Graham Cassidy, I think, that they were trying to push through on repealing Obamacare back in September, so that I guess CHIP just fell by the wayside as they were working on everything else. And then DACA is 100% at Trump's doorstep, really, because it was his executive order that put it on the chopping block in the first place. So yeah, it's the height of hypocrisy.
Now, I see you saying this and putting these blames on Trump. But really, isn't he just doing his best to prevent people from shithole countries from coming here?
Well, these are people that are already here.
I have it on fairly good authority that the majority of people on DACA are brown. I think I rest my case on the shithole country.
Oh, man. Jeez. Yeah, subtext becomes text. Yeah, it's terrible. You know, and yeah, everything about it is infuriating.
The DACA decision, on Trump's part at least, was put on hold by a court recently who just kind of put a pause on the whole procedure. The government has asked the Supreme Court to intervene on that. I think it's probably pretty likely the government will get a stay on that order.
Yeah, and I think what they're likely to get at the end of the day is this is still an area of law that is largely under the authority of the president to enforce or not. I mean, that's how DACA came into play in the first place, was Obama putting into place these orders that saying they're not going to take action on this specific group of immigrants. So it's perfectly legal and constitutional for Trump to yank out the carpet on them and start the deportations. It's, you know, horrifying morally, and he shouldn't do it. It's an awful, awful thing to do, but I don't think the courts are going to be the ones that are going to save these people. It's going to have to be some kind of legislative action now that Trump has decided this is the course that he's going to take.
The government shutdown doesn't look like it's heading for any sort of quick resolution. People thought maybe there'd be some brainstorming this weekend, but Democrats have come out of their meeting. Resilient was one of the terms that was used by a reporter at the scene. Re-energized. They really feel like this is a fight worth fighting for, and the numbers don't really lie. DACA is incredibly popular, even among Republicans. CHIP is likewise pretty much bulletproof in the court of public opinion.
Right. And yeah, hence the Republican strategy, they're trying to separate them out and say, okay, we've got CHIP and we'll go forward with that. But, you know, DACA, that will have to be dealt with in a separate bill, which they will block. They won't allow it to go through the House. You could probably, it's a question as to whether or not they would let it through the Senate under those circumstances, unless they were facing the kind of deadline that comes with keeping the government running, keeping the lights on. So, it's hard to see how this comes forward and where a compromise is reached. Someone's going to have to feel political pain, and I think the Democrats have good reason to think that the public opinion is on their side. You know, the only caveat I would say, or the only caution, is that I think the numbers are not quite as good when the question is, should there be a government shutdown to protect DACA, DACA recipients? And that's the big question that we'll see, is whether or not the Democrats are able to hold on and keep on, keep up the fight and maintain their position in the face of whatever pressure might come to get the government back up and running again, get public facilities up and running again, get public employees their paychecks. All of that is going to start to weigh pretty heavily on both sides, but the question is who is going to hit harder and who's going to cave.
The pressure may come sooner than I think anybody thinks. Tomorrow, Sunday, as we discussed in the pre-show, is the NFL championship games. The NFC and the AFC has their conference championship games. The American military members serving overseas will not be able to see those broadcasts. The AFN, the Armed Forces Network, which provides television and radio services to all American troops serving abroad, has shut down. It's not broadcasting.
Oh, in the shit, me.
Nope, 100% serious. The NFL has, after becoming aware of the situation, stepped in to provide USO lounges with free NFL Sunday ticket passes so that they could watch the game. But that helps out troops in, say, Germany or Japan. There aren't a lot of USO lounges in the Middle East, for example.
No, yeah, if you're in Afghanistan, you're kind of out of luck.
Exactly. So that's something that may hit home pretty quick. The NFL is, while not apolitical, as evidenced by the whole, kneeling for the national anthem made-up controversy with Trump earlier, it is kind of a cultural touchstone in this country. We all have football.
Well, yeah, and especially if you got a bunch of Florida voting troops from Jacksonville who potentially see their team in the Super Bowl this year, except they're not able to watch. That's bad for morale.
Yeah, you don't say.
Yeah.
Moving on from the government shutdown, this was the one-year anniversary of the Women's March across America. We had a very well-attended turnout in Portland, in Seattle, New York, and D.C. I had the National March. It was a sight to behold, and it was something that really gave us a lot of hope in the dark days of Trump's initial inauguration. On this one-year anniversary, we've had an anniversary march in many cities. Portland's was rather sparsely attended, I do have to say. Seattle's was huge. New York City put 200,000 people on the street, I was reading.
Wow. A year later.
Yeah.
I mean, the immediacy is a little bit less now that we've been living with Trump for a year. But at least, yeah, like you said, turnout in Seattle was comparable. From what I could tell in Bellingham, it's been, fairly comparable to last year as well. Not quite those same high figures, but of course, yeah, things aren't quite as immediate now. And the one thing I had noticed, at least in terms of what's going on in the different marches where I'm seeing pictures from and things like that, is there's a lot of focus on the next step, the action, putting it into democratic, small d democratic action, and lots of groups getting people signed up to vote. And I think that's where the next step of this really has to be, is turning it into a political result.
And the success of groups such as Run for Something, I think, really speaks to that too. Just getting people not just aware of issues, but involved in changing them. whether it be voting or whether it be an instrument of democratic powers, such as an elected representative, getting people to feel like their opinions matter is a way to really start saving some whatever remaining faith Americans have in their institutions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's so, yeah, it's good to see that it's still going, that there is still the potential to use a lot of this energy that was generated by the horror of us entering the darkest timeline a little over a year ago.
Let's stick with darkest timeline, I think, then, and we'll talk about the Stormy Daniels affair. And I mean affair literally in this case. Stormy Daniels, as you are probably aware now, is former, has been, adult film star. She's still in the industry.
I think she's pushing 40, so I'm assuming she's not.
Yeah, if you're not Jenna Jameson, they don't let you stick around that long.
Yeah, audience, we're going to assume you're just learning who Stormy Daniels is and that you're not already well familiar with her oeuvre.
Stormy Daniels was a young, up-and-coming porn star. I mean, I think I was vaguely aware of her, like, my freshman year of college or something. And I guess in 2006, correct?
Yes, that's when this affair is alleged to have
happened. Yeah, she was allegedly... And when I say allegedly, I mean admitted in a supposedly sealed court document that nobody's supposed to know about. She was paid by Trump for sex to cheat on his wife fairly shortly after he married his current wife.
I think, was it after he married her or was it after Barron was born? I think it's one of those tawdry details or another.
Yeah, and this was apparently an exceptionally shitty affair. He told this woman that he liked her because she looked like Ivanka, which is his daughter that he has made several inappropriate comments about wanting to date. At one point, I think your favorite detail of the story, Trump asked her to spank him with a Time magazine with his face on the cover, which I can... totally believe. 100%. I don't even need to see confirmation for that. That fits every fact I know about the man.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the run amok ego and, yeah, gratification in various ways. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a payoff, a non-disclosure agreement. The National Enquirer found out about this story, interviewed Stormy Daniels with numerous tawdry details, and then decided not to publish. Trump is BFF with the publisher of the National Enquirer. It's his favorite newspaper, despite the fact that it's a tabloid that just makes shit up and sells itself in supermarket aisles. But the Enquirer really had Trump's back and actually broke some news during the last election about his Republican opponents seemingly working hand in hand with the Trump organization. So there's a little bit of a question about why they decided to can this story after they'd found it all out. And also, the president has said that he can't be blackmailed because he's so rich. But this kind of lends a lie to that.
Yeah, he's paying blackmail, actually.
Yeah. That's
exactly what it looks like. Yeah. Not just the Enquirer. I think I've seen elsewhere that Fox News had the story and Slate, quite a few organizations had this and had it in the brief run-up to the election. I think they were spiking this story in, I want to say September, October, from what I've read. It's just seems pretty, I don't want to get all butterfly effect here, but that seems like it would have been a pretty consequential thing, considering how close the election was.
Can you really say that this news story would have been consequential when there's nothing about proper email security management anywhere in the story?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not impeachable in that way. So You've got it there. I mean, that's not the big story of the 2016 election. So I guess they just couldn't find a sexy hook for it.
Yeah. The whole thing is weird. When the story was getting published, the president's lawyer sent a letter signed by Stormy Daniels addressed to whoever it concerns, completely denying any and all allegations. It sounds a lot to me like he has a bunch of copies of that letter in a drawer somewhere because there is something to these allegations.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's why you would probably get a letter like that.
Yeah.
It seems weird for a person to go around collecting letters or affidavits or whatever from porn stars saying that, no, I did not have sex with you.
When he was asked for comment from the newspaper, Trump's lawyer was Cohen, I believe, told them he'd get back to them shortly, and then 16 minutes later provided them with a signed letter from Stormy Daniels telling them that nothing had ever happened. He didn't call up Stormy and get that letter in 16 minutes. He had that. That was sitting ready in a drawer, like a break glass in case of story.
Yeah, pretty clearly. Oh, man. Yeah, it's looks like he done did it. I was, you know, when we first heard about this, my thought was, you know, considering all the gross things Trump has done, you know, having sex with a porn star is actually pretty normal and kind of humanizing compared to all the rest of the stuff he does. You know, she's not related to him. It wasn't clear immediately that he paid her. So, you know, consent, you know, great. Still, though, it's, you know, the very 2018 kind of story that this is the story that we're hearing about the president, you know, this week. And it, in the grand scheme of things, we're treating it like it's not that big a deal, like we wouldn't be freaking the hell out.
As if Clinton didn't get impeached for this exact thing, cheating on his wife and then getting somebody to lie about it. Like, there was a time the Republican Party considered this an impeachable offense. I don't even think it reached the top 10 of most talked about shit on cable news this week.
No, it's probably not the most impeachable thing that's been discussed about Trump this week. So, yeah, it's just such a bizarre presidency. This is just one more piece of it.
I do want to issue a correction for something I said earlier. I said it was a Time magazine with his face on it. The Forbes magazine with his face on it that he was spanked with. I don't want anybody to think that we're some sort of rag.
Right.
Do you read Crooks and Liars at all?
From time to time, yeah. I'm familiar with their work.
Their article on this story has, like, a side-by-side face shot of Stormy Daniels and Ivanka Trump. They actually do kind of look alike.
Oh, of course they do. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Like, Trump's not wrong there. They do.
He's still wrong. He's just wrong in a different way. It's so wrong.
All right. We're early, but I guess we'll turn into the local stuff now.
Sure.
Oregon has a citizens' repeal measure on the ballot coming up just this week. In fact, I believe it's tomorrow or a couple days after that. It's got to be in.
I think,
23rd.
Tuesday would. 21st?
23rd, Tuesday.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So this summer, the Oregon legislature passed a package of bills that was intended to fully fund the Medicare expansion in the state. The federal contribution for Medicare expansion gradually winds down to 90%. It started at 100% when you first signed up for it. And over the course of several years, it winds down. By 2020, the feds will only provide 90% of the cost, and that will continue from that year on. In order to cover the other 10%, Oregon has implemented a series of taxes and assessments that mostly hit healthcare plans sold within the state. Not hugely impactful. It's a 0.7% tax on assessments for hospitals. It's 1.5% assessment on premiums that you pay on your health insurance. It's really fairly small change in order to cover a great many number of people. But the legislature, in doing so, tipped the anger of the conservatives in the state who didn't want Medicaid to be expanded in the first place, and they were able to get a repeal measure on the ballot. Basically, it puts a pause on the legislature's law, allows the public to vote on it, and then decides whether or not it goes into force or not. This is one that there's a lot of money flowing into for this. The national conservative media does not much like Medicaid expansion. We talked last week about Kentucky trying to really pull back on that, and allowing liberal progressive states such as Oregon willy-nilly to go about this is not something that they want to do. So with all that said, they have been pouring money into this, was huge amounts, and we're finally coming to the close on this. I don't think they're going to be able to repeal it. The Medicaid expansion is popular in the state. It's hugely popular. Everybody in the state basically knows somebody who is covered underneath it. So.
So, is this industry money that's been pouring in to oppose it, or like ideological groups you were mentioning?
Mostly ideological groups.
Kochs and okay.
In
The
fact,
usual bad guys.
most of the medical industry, including the hospital industry, which you might expect to be against it because they are hit with a tax, supports it completely. The
Sure.
everything from all the individual like boards on the American Medical Association to groups that you normally wouldn't necessarily see in things such as this, various Jewish groups, various pediatric groups, the NAACP is behind it. The NARAL Pro-Choice America is behind it. These are the Catholic charities are on the same side as, you know, things like Renew Oregon, which is a very progressive group that you would not normally see together. I do not actually see anything derailing this, but the fact that they were able to get it onto the ballot is a little bit disconcerting. They need a fairly significant number of signatures corresponding to a percentage of people who voted on this. There's been over $3 million spent on this campaign so far. I do have to say the vast majority of it is in favor of the taxes, which makes me feel pretty nice about the whole thing.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, this is Oregon, at least, from the time I was there and from a little bit before too. I mean, ballot measures were the main vehicle for putting in conservative policy objectives. I mean, this was the Bill Sizemore's weapon of choice for years and years. So I guess, there's still enough people in the in that world to know how to, get the measures on the ballot the way they want to. But yeah, hopefully things turn out the right way and that's defeated, because that, the Medicaid expansion, as we've said many times, that's where so much of the additional, people being insured came from under Obamacare.
Yeah. The main group leading the charge against this ballot measure, so in favor of repealing the taxes, is the Taxpayer Association of Oregon, which is our state branch of the Taxpayer Association of America, which
Sure.
is a bunch of movement conservative fuckheads and radio talk show hosts.
Right. That makes sense. Well, boo on them and hope they lose. Hope they've wasted a lot of money.
Yeah, I imagine they will, but we'll also check in on this next week. We've got two things going on up there in Seattle, I believe. I guess only one, because we already kind of talked about the Women's March. But Amazon has been shopping around for a second headquarter. We talked about this a little bit in the Facebook group, because Amazon also just recently doubled their office space in Portland, signed the new lease on the first. It brings their web services team, based out of Portland, up to a 800 employee maximum, which they're targeting with hires now. I read that into, or I read into that, excuse me, that there might be a little bit of corporate gravity pulling into Portland for Amazon. We were putting together a fairly aggressive bid for Amazon's second headquarter. I tempered that a little bit. We are extremely close to Seattle. You could leave Seattle and make an afternoon meeting in Portland. So if they looked at this as just like a branch office of their main headquarters, that could negate it. But I was fairly hopeful, and it is hopeful. I know JJ, if he were here, would talk a lot about what Amazon does to, you know, the workforce, raising prices and rents up. That's a lot of high-paying jobs, though. Like, I would have loved to see those come here. You posted a link, too, that I guess we'll talk about in a second here. That was another look at that. Amazon, a city killer from Prospect. But lo and behold, Portland is not on that list. Nowhere in the Pacific Northwest, I believe, is on that list. It's Atlanta, Austin, Boston, Chicago, Columbus, Dallas, Denver, Indianapolis, Miami, Montgomery County, I'm assuming Alabama, Nashville, Newark, NYC, Northern Virginia, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Raleigh, Toronto, Washington, D.C. That pretty much covers the entire, like, smattering of the U.S. outside of the West Coast.
I was just going to say, not just outside of the Pacific Northwest, but the entire West Coast is out.
Yeah, really. Once you get to the Rocky Mountains, then you can't go more than 200 miles without hitting something that Amazon has said could be their next headquarters.
Right. Yeah. So I guess, you know, maybe a little bit of geographic diversity or something. You know,
see, I was thinking of it in the opposite way. This is a way for them to say they really haven't made a decision at all yet. Wherever they want to go, they can basically go there with this list.
Sure. Yeah, the whole country's open, I guess, you know, apart, again, from where they already are. So if they were going to be, you know, just making, I guess, auxiliary or secondary, you know, parts of their main headquarters in Portland, they could certainly do that with, you know, what they have here.
Let's talk about the Prospect article then. You've probably spent more time chewing over this. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what the background on this?
Well, the main beef that this article has, and it's it's titled, like you said, Amazon, a City Killer, points out that, like you mentioned, Amazon has brought a great deal of wealth into Seattle, a lot of wealthy people, especially in their executive and knowledge worker groups. But it also points out that, you know, a large number of their workforce, both in Seattle and around the country, particularly those folks working in their warehouse divisions, are fairly underpaid relative to the area where they work. Seattle, you know, this article points out, is they're being paid 18% less than the average wage for the area. Some of the other sites that they cited here were Kenosha, Wisconsin, at 22% less than the prevailing wage. Atlanta, Columbia, 18-19%. So an average of 15% less than the going wage in the geographic area where these warehouses are located.
Is that the going wage for warehouse work in those areas, or is that just the going wage across all sectors?
It appears to be purportedly the going rate for warehouse workers.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, I certainly have a love-hate relationship with Amazon. It's, you know, probably the most convenient way to shop. And, you know, coming out of Alaska, where retail was so few and far between anyway, it was really the only option for a lot of items. But, you know, one of the things that I think all of us, you know, more progressive-minded people have to kind of reckon with is it's largely the Walmart of the internet. And there have been repeated, you know, media exposés on their, you know, human resource practices, both, you know, among their office workers and in their more blue-collar warehouse set. So, yeah, the fact that both are located pretty heavily in Seattle, you know, the article suggests is contributing to the inequality of the city. You know, you get more high-paid employees in a city in large numbers. It's drives up the cost of living, you know, for your rents and then, you know, property values. Everything starts costing more, and that's just anecdotally, you can look at Seattle, and that's clearly the case. You know, the cost of living there has skyrocketed in the last decade, and it has ripple effects throughout the region. You know, I've increasingly seeing more and more neighbors here, you know, 100 miles from Seattle, who commute into the city. Not a lot of them in Bellingham, but you go, you know, 20, 30 miles from here in cities like Mount Vernon. Yeah, people commute to Seattle from there. You know, the way the cost is, you know, that hour and a half commute each way ends up being worth it if it saves you a few hundred dollars on rent.
Now, I have a question here, and this probably reflects some of the inner struggles I go through with trying to form an opinion on this. It seems a little bit from your argument that you were picking out of both baskets there. The problem for the warehouse workers is they aren't paid enough, but then the problem for everybody else is that the other people on Amazon are paid too much, and they drive the cost up. Seems like both directions on that are a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the story of income inequality, really. You know, you've got concentration of wealth with certain types of workers and not much left over for the rest. And if they're sharing a geographic space, then those workers that are paid less are increasingly getting priced out.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those issues that's been around for forever, and we're still wrestling with it. How do we really make a rising tide lift all boats? How do we make sure that the tide is rising for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question. I mean, you know, pressure on companies like this to see that, you know, the benefits are shared all across their labor chain. Of course, the way that companies like Amazon or Walmart, for that matter, they make a profit, or they generate the low prices that bring about their customer base by saving money on the labor end, you know. And so the people who work in their warehouses or the people that work in their supply chains end up getting squeezed. That's where they can exert the pressure, and that's how they can keep prices low. I mean, it's basically the cheapest, where is the cheapest retailer for almost anything, and it's in nearly any sector of retail that you can think of.
I'm going to issue the second correction of the episode from the Prospect article. Montgomery County was not the Montgomery County I thought. In Alabama, Montgomery County, Maryland, which is the county in between. It touches D.C. and it touches Baltimore County.
Okay.
So it's the one in between them.
It's not where Wallace went to hide out in season one of The Wire.
No. That's such a great show.
It really is.
All right. Well, that's just about going to wrap it up. So, short episode this week. We'll have JJ back next week, I presume, to tell us why everything we said was wrong, enlighten us a little bit about what Amazon is really doing to a city. I don't live in Seattle. Dan doesn't live in Seattle. So, we look forward to a firsthand look next week. I guess we'll settle into what are you following? So, sure. Dan, go ahead and kick us off.
All right, so I am a little late to the bandwagon on this one, but my wife and I just started watching it this week. The Good Place on NBC. I don't know if you've seen this yet.
I have not.
An amazing situation comedy. It just came back from a mid-season hiatus on its second season now. The premise is that Kristen Bell is a lout, bad person who has died and ended up in heaven or something approximating it. And where it goes from there is pretty mind-blowing. It's the most mature and one of the more thought-provoking television shows I've seen dealing with issues of metaphysics and the afterlife and ethics. And it's on network television. It's on NBC. It's fantastic. So check out The Good Place. It's coming into its final few episodes of its second season, and I guess it's been renewed for a third season. The one caveat I would say is do not just pick it up and watch where it is now, because also this is a brave choice for network television. If you start watching it in media res, it's almost completely incomprehensible. You have to start from the beginning, basically. So, yeah, it's very highly serialized, but I highly recommend it.
I will 100% check it out. That sounds fantastic.
Yep, first season's on Netflix, and yeah, that's probably where you get it best.
I will dive into the exact same thing. Netflix has picked up a bunch of names that I'm very excited about. Paul Schaefer did a Christmas special with Bill Murray called A Very Murray Christmas. It was great. It was basically, Murray was the star, but it was basically a Paul Schaefer special. And Paul's old partner, David Letterman, has a new interview series on Netflix that starts with him sitting down with former President Obama. And it was probably the best hour of television. It was absolutely incredible. It was unguarded in a way that current presidents can't be and current TV shows hosts can't be either. The fact that they were both retired made it just absolutely fantastic. There's very long cameos with, I'm forgetting his name now, the representative who marched across the Selma Bridge with Martin Luther.
John Lewis.
John Lewis. There are very moving interludes with John Lewis where him and Letterman walk across that bridge together, and just Lewis talks about his life and how the entire civil rights movement ended up with where we are now, and it is an incredibly moving piece of cinema. And if you're going to go on Netflix to find that show, you should check out that one too, because I really like it. The second episode, which is not up yet, they're going to be doing one a month, has George Clooney in it. Malala is going to be one of the guests. There's some real heavy hitters on that list, and I think everybody should really check it out and take a look.
Sounds great. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me, Dan. This has been the January 20th edition of Cascadian Views, and see everybody next week.
All right. See ya.
All right. Have a good one, man.